You're listening to the Think Unbroken podcast, and I'm your host, Michael Unbroken. I'm an author, speaker, coach, and advocate for adult survivors of childhood trauma and abuse. In this podcast, you will learn how to transform your trauma into triumph, turn breakdowns into breakthroughs, and go from victim to being the hero of your own story. You can learn more at thinkunbrokenpodcast.com, and of course, check us out on Apple Podcasts and Spotify at Think Unbroken Podcast. Steve Wilson, welcome to the podcast, brother.
Thank you very much, Michael.
I'm very excited to have you. You are the author of Teetering on a Tightrope, My Bipolar Journey.
Yes.
You have an incredible background now at 75 years old. You have the distinct pleasure of being a guest that I've been looking forward to talking to for a while. Because I'm going to hopefully take out some brilliant nuggets, as I'm going to affectionately label you as our eldest guest in the history of the show with over 750 episodes. So it's an honor to have you here today. I'm thrilled to have you. I guess really what I'd like to just kind of jump right in, I'm going to ask a question maybe no one's asked you, because I'm so curious. Living now, creating an amazing life, writing this beautiful book, what I'm really curious about is why.
Why did I write it?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you what. It actually started about 5 or 6 years ago. I was having a few issues that I had not been able to solve on my mental journey. And I sought out a trauma therapist here in Scottsdale. And she was tremendous. She started me looking back at my life from my earliest memory and taking me through every part of my life up until 5 or 6 years ago. When we got done, she said, God, there's a lot of stuff in this. Mm-hmm. I think you ought to write a book. And I had previously, in my 20s, been a sports writer. So I thought it'd be fun to kind of get back into that. So that's how the book came about. And, you know, it took a long time to write it, but it was fairly easy because everything was laid out for me. And I would just write on each thing that came on in my lifetime. So I really enjoyed it. I think it has a message to people who, one, are suffering from a mental illness, or two, their parents or siblings or friends of someone mentally ill, or they are the millions of people who don't even think about mental illness very often. They have a stigma against it because of what the media tells them and so on. And I want to get the word out that, hey, we're normal people. We have a problem just like if somebody had a broken leg. Mm. So that's the way the book came about.
I think that's a really beautiful point to make because, you know, growing up, my mother had bipolar. She was narcissistic, schizophrenic, institutionalized multiple times. And I felt the impact of that on my brothers, on myself, my sister, our entire family. And look, I like to step in these conversations, Steve, with full transparency. Growing up and being that young, obviously, I didn't understand it. And I would just tell people my mom was crazy because that's all I had to leverage. I didn't know mental health. It wasn't a conversation. It certainly wasn't a conversation how it is now. And I watched that disease take her life, right? Ultimately, at the end of the day. And I think that there is this tremendous stigma attached to it. And just as much as it is, to your words, a broken leg, so much of this is you don't get to see the injury, right? Like you don't get to see the cast because it's in our, it's in their heads or in your mind and your psyche. What was it like for you in the beginning stages of your journey, kind of reflecting back on your youth in your 20s, 30s and the impact of this?
Well, we'll go way before my 20s and 30s to 1958. I was 9 years old. Up until that time, I'd been a pretty normal kid, a lot of friends, played a lot of sport, loving family, so on and so forth. Then one day, I went to my local movie theater to watch. Back then, they would do double features. You'd watch a couple Westerns. They cut them off in the middle, and then you'd start a new one. But anyway, at the break between the movies, I went up to the concession stand to get a Coke. And this gentleman, who I didn't know, put a dime in the Coke machine and bought me a Coke. And I said, thanks. He says, would you come here and do something for me? I need some help. I said, sure. Remember, I'm only about that tall. And I didn't know what the hell the guy wanted. So he takes me into the bathroom and says, take down your pants. And he proceeded to rape me. Now, in 1958, there was not much help, especially not much help for a kid of 9 years old who was accusing an adult of sexual assault. I didn't know anything about it. Didn't even know what he'd done. I was in shock. And I said, geez, why did this happen to me? And I said, what did I do wrong? And did I look like I was someone you'd choose out of a crowd to do this to? So I decided to tell nobody. Not my parents, not my brother and sister, no friends, nobody. And I didn't for 30 years. Now, fast forward to later on that same year, I had my first major depressive order. Now, I want to say something right here because it is important that people understand two things. One, there is environmental causes of mental illness. An environmental cause would be the guy who raped me. And the other cause can be genetic. There is no pure answer for which it's going to be, or do they both interconnect? So I'm not sure that the rape caused me to start having depression or whether depression would have come anyway. I just wanted to get that out first because people automatically jump to the fact that I got raped and that caused it. And it's probably a big cause, but I don't know. Anyway, I had my first depressive incident about 2 or 3 months later. I was an A student, a very good athlete, so on and so forth. I quit everything. Never studied again, all that. My grades dropped like a rock. I didn't play with my friends. I thought I was worthless, thought nobody loved me, thought I was alone in the world. It was terrible. That went on for about 2 months maybe, and then I gradually got out of it and went on, and that came back in seventh grade. And in ninth grade at different times, because being bipolar is like being on a roller coaster. You have your ups where you're pretty normal, and then you sink down into a deep depression. Now, speaking of that, that's bipolar two. Bipolar one is that you have the depression, and then you go into a full-blown mania. And you spend all your money, you ruin your family connections, you think you're the greatest thing in the world. When you crash, your life is torn upside down. I never had mania, I've never had it in my life, but I did have tremendous depression. So that went on through high school, and in college it was that way. But again, remember, it's up and down, so it's not like I'm screwed up all the time. So nobody really noticed. And when I got out of college, I was at my worst, very suicidal. I was always a swimmer, and I would swim laps every day. When I started the suicidal ideations, I would dive in the pool, start swimming, and on each stroke, I would say, kill yourself, kill yourself. And that went on for a while. And then one night we had a barbecue at my parents' house. Now remember, they didn't know any of this about the rape or anything. So I had a barbecue at my parents' house. And my dad and I never really got along. So he came up to me when I was cooking burgers and he pushed me away and he says, "You don't know what you're doing. I'll do it." Well, I got in a fight with him. And the next day I woke up and I was in a mental institution. And I was there for 3 weeks. That probably saved my life.
I want to pause you there, Steve.
Go.
First, thank you for sharing that. There's so many avenues we can dive down into this. The one that comes to mind for me immediately is, one, just sending that young child, Steve, just so much love, man. You know, I've shared this publicly on the show. I was molested by someone from the church when I was around the same age. And it does impact you forever. And it does something that takes away your love, your belief, your self-esteem, your confidence, your safety amongst everything else. And whereas you remain silent, I'd shared with my mother. And my mother told me, never tell anyone that happened. And I didn't talk about it again for almost 21 years. And I remember thinking about this very vividly in the recent past as I was coaching one of my clients. And I just couldn't help but wonder if we had a space for people to have this conversation, what would the outcome of their life look like? For me, one of the things that saved my life ultimately at 26 years old, which it's funny, man, I kind of laugh because I always go, man, your 20s, if you have a midlife crisis when you're like 25, you're not doing too bad. And I think to myself, you know, thank God for therapy, for coaching, for a lot of the elements that we had. It was never institutionalized. I'm sure that was probably the protocol then. You said that it saved your life. I want to go into that for a minute because we're living in a mental health crisis right now in America where, especially amongst men, they're isolated, they're quiet, they're terrified to have a conversation like you and I are having right now. Why did that save your life? Like, what happened?
Well, my mother is the one who got me involved with a psychiatrist because she had some mental problems and she had used a psychiatrist at a very well-known mental hospital called Harding Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. And she got me in there and I started having therapy and that helped a lot, but I had no medication. And the medication was helping a little bit, but it was after that that I got really bad and had started having the suicidal thoughts. When they put me in the institution, which, by the way, that institution was nothing like what you might imagine. It was like going to a country club. I had my own room. There was tennis. There was basketball. There were all kinds of things back then. That's why this place was so renowned, because it served people really well. But anyway, I got on more medication in there and through all the therapy and things after 3 weeks, I don't think I've had a suicidal ideation since then.
Wow.
Now, at that time, they diagnosed me as clinical depression. And then they started putting me on the drugs for depression. None of them worked. Now, remember, today, if you turn on your TV, every other ad is something for bipolar or depression, something like that. Back then, there might have been 4 medications, if I was lucky. And I took all of them, and they made me really sick. And they also made me, my mind just go crazy with ruminations. So I did that in 1972. 6 years later, my psychiatrist came in and said, "We made a mistake. You're not clinically depressed, you're bipolar. And they switched me over to lithium, which I didn't even know what it was. And I didn't know what bipolar was either. And so in a matter of days, the lithium took hold. I immediately became 50% better, and I could function in life again starting in 1978. Up until that time, I failed at every job, treated my friends and my wife not badly, but everything revolved around me because I was still pretty down with the depression and the bipolar. But the lithium is really, once I got out of the hospital, what saved my life.
That's incredible. And, you know, it's funny because as you were speaking, my thought in my head was like, I bet he's going to say lithium. And, you know, that you've seen so many different things be so many drugs be life-changing for people, but also so many because of medical misdiagnosis is actually the number one cause of death in America. I don't know if you knew this or not, but it kind of points.
Would you say
medical misdiagnosis is the number one cause of death in America?
Oh, yeah.
In a hospital, in a hospital setting, right? And one of the things that I have just a vast appreciation for is when we're lucky enough where somebody gets it right and admits that they got it right or wrong, and they go, okay, this is the way that we solve this problem. What I'm curious about, you know, how do you like go down the path? Like once you have this diagnosis and then, I mean, my God, 1978, I can't imagine, like it's like probably even still carrying a bit of a secret. Like, how do you navigate life? Because we're looking at world. What I'm trying to get here is this evolution that you've gone through, Steve, which I think is incredibly powerful, right? Because there's so many people I know who are listening to this show who they hide it. It's a secret. It's taking away from them every day that they have suffering or abuse or they have a mental disorder or diagnosis. And it's like, how do you still live? Like, that's kind of what I'm getting to here. It's like, you have all these things transpired. You finally get on the right medication. That's like, great. Now what?
Well, I was very fortunate. As I said, my work life was a disaster. Every job was terrible. I screwed up everything. I ruined businesses. I did all that stuff. But I had a wonderful home life. I had great friends. And I think that I had two separate lives. I had my work life, which was a disaster, and I had my family and friend life, which was tremendous. I had three kids, three girls. They're all grown now. They've got grandkids. And that's really what pulled me through. And I will say that the therapy, which continued, and the drugs, not only the lithium, but there were other drugs that stopped the ruminations. Ruminations are a runaway mind. You just can't stop thinking about everything. It's bad. It just drives you crazy. Well, I got a drug for that in the year 2000, and it worked very well. But the lithium, again, is the one that made me able to work and be kind of successful. And that's that really the two things, the lithium and my home life, made my journey acceptable. I want to tell you one other thing, because we were talking a minute ago about not telling anybody. Somewhere in about 1985, which would have been about 27 or 28 years after my molestation, I got up the guts to tell my psychiatrist what had happened. I told him I had been molested or raped, whatever I told him. And he looked at me and he said, "How are you today?" I said, "Well, I'm fine, but don't you want to talk about that? And I'm having a tough time dealing with it." He said, "No, let's go on to something else." And that incident probably put me back 10 years from making it worse for 10 years than it needed to be. I did not tell anybody after that until 2015 when I told my wife. So I guess what my message is that if anyone gets in to therapy, you've got to be your own advocate. If a therapist says something you don't like, call him on it. If he gives you medication that you've had before and it didn't work, tell him. Don't let them do everything for you.
Yeah, our suffering is in our silence. I think yes. about this all the time. You know, it's funny because I've had this conversation on the show before, talking about how I fired therapists over the years. You know, and a big part of the reason why is because of just what you said. And look, here's the truth, and you know this as well as I do, Steve. They're people too, right? They are fallible. Just because you have a college education does not make you qualified. And the human experience is so difficult to manage just for ourselves as individuals. And I would be willing to bet, and I don't know this because I wasn't there, but I would be willing to bet that therapists probably had some kind of sexual abuse themselves that they had probably never dealt with. To throw that away so quickly, like, that's a red flag, right? And to advocate for yourself really truly is the thing that'll set you free. Let's go into that moment with your wife specifically for a moment. Two questions. How long had you been married, and what was it like for you to sit down and finally tell her and free yourself of that burden?
Well, as of today, we've been married 51 years.
It's amazing.
And so that puts it back about 10 years ago. So we've been married about 41 or 2 years at that time. Now, she always knew that I was mentally in trouble and had some problems. What she didn't know was that I'd been raped. And I explained it to her, and she listened very nicely and was very comforting. And then the next thing we did a couple of days later was tell my kids and my grandkids, and got everything out in the open. And I think it was one of the best things I've ever done. Get the truth out there. I was no longer burdened by thoughts of the rape. And I tell you, I don't even know what the guy looked like who raped me. I've never had the problem of seeing his face, so I didn't get all of that extra trauma.
I wrote a note here, and I wrote, how did telling the truth change you?
You know, I felt unburdened. A lot of people knew that I was bipolar. A lot of my friends knew I'd told them and all that. But when I told my wife and kids about the rape, it unburdened me. I no longer had to tell somebody I've got a mental illness, but I'd have to stop myself so I wouldn't tell them what actually happened to me. Now I could tell everybody. And that's one reason I was able to write the book, too, because it no longer threatened me.
Hey, Unbroken Nation, we'll be right back to the show, but I wanted to let you know that you can grab a copy of my first book, Think Unbroken, Understanding and Overcoming Childhood Trauma, for free. If you go to book.thinkunbroken.com, you can download the PDF ebook version of the book and get everything that I know about the baseline of healing trauma for free, downloaded to your email right now. Just go to book.thinkunbroken.com to download your copy of Think Unbroken, Understanding and Overcoming Childhood Trauma for a PDF for your phone. Again, that is book.thinkunbroken.com.
When I look back on my journey, you know, at I think I'd have been 28 was the first time I ever shared half the things that had happened to me. And it was on the front side of it. Here's what's so interesting. on the front side of making the decision, I'm sitting in my bedroom with my then girlfriend. I'm getting ready to pack up my life to go to another state to go work with this renowned trauma therapist. Because I'd reached this place in life where it was, I had destroyed everything. Like, there's no other way to put it. My life was a complete disaster. But I'd been doing some of the work, but it wasn't like working, right? I was doing the work, but it wasn't working. And I was like, there's got to be something different here. And 28 years old, I told the truth to someone outside of myself for the first time. Mm-hmm. On the front side of it, it was the most terrifying thing I've ever done in my life. And Steve, I've spoken on stage in front of 10,000 people. To tell the truth in a breath was more terrifying than anything. And simultaneously, immediately after, was the most free I've ever been. And for me, it was freedom. And to this day, it is freedom. Now, of course, there's things, and I've said this before, I'll never share on this show. I just don't think they benefit the world, but it's for my therapist, for my coach, and for my journal. That freedom transforms your life forever. And what I would love for you to talk about is, what was it like after sharing? What happened in life with your wife, with your children, with your grandchildren, with your friends, and now with the people that you're helping who read the book? But like, what started to happen in your life after telling the truth?
Well, I think before we talk about what happened after, we need to go back to what it was like before. And there were incidents in my life that have had impacts on how much better I got. And one of the, well, first of all, when I was still bad in the 20s, I wanted to be a golf pro. Now, not a playing pro, but a club pro. I wanted to run my own golf course, country club. But I got so bad mentally that I told my head pro what was going on, and he more or less turned his back on me. So I quit that job. Then I had other jobs, and I quit each one of those, or was fired because I couldn't handle a job. Then I got in business with my father. He had a clothing business in Ohio, men's and women's, and I worked there for several years, not liking it, but getting through. And then I bought him out, and then I ruined the business, and I closed it. Now, you'd think that that would be a terrible thing. For me, it was the beginning of the rest of my life because all that stuff was behind me. But I still had not told anybody about my rape. That was 1995. And I've had, since then, I've been a custom clothing salesperson, which means I would go around the United States selling custom clothing on an individual basis. And I had all the freedom in the world, and it felt great. And that continued until 2008. We moved to Arizona. Still hadn't told my wife, but life was good. And then comes 2015, and I don't remember what precipitated me to tell her. But I told her, I didn't think about it. I just told her. In our bedroom, in bed, that night. And ever since then, I have felt the freedom I've never felt before. I continue to be a custom tailor out here in the Phoenix area. I'm not religious, so I didn't get anything out of the saving my life or anything else from God. I don't believe in that. So it was faith in myself that took over after I told my wife and got it off my chest. And you know what? I think it was also very helpful that she didn't go crazy that I told her I was raped, because Some people go, oh, God, that's how. What'd you do to cause that? So my life since 2015 has been really good. We love it out here in Phoenix. And I just retired in 2019 and have a great retirement going on.
Yeah. First, congratulations. I mean, if you ever heard the adage that the truth will set you free, I mean, I think this certainly adds up, right? And I look at my journey and my hope, and the reason why I wanted to have this conversation with you is my hope was that we could inspire some more people to just set themselves free. Now, here's what's interesting, though, is you look at your life, and even though you'd had these moments, you told your wife, and you had so much work being done, you still went to a trauma therapist. And here's what's so interesting to me about you. Most people, I'm going to generalize, and you know I'm right, all right, with what I'm about to say. Most people of a certain age, they're, nope, my life is done. It's over with. It doesn't matter. I can't change. Woe is me. They play a victim. You know this. I know this. Why do you still continue to do the work?
Well, for my own reasons of going to the therapist, was basically because I still had a couple things that were nagging me and were on my mind all the time. One of them was a very passionate time I had with a lady in college, and I was deeply in love, and she tossed me aside. I never got over that. And I never also got over what impact the rape had on me. So those two things drove me to say, I want to figure this out. This is a good time, and let's do it. Got those two things figured out, and I don't see a therapist anymore. I really haven't seen a therapist since about 2005 or so, because I really haven't needed one, but I was lying to myself. I did need one and thought I was really good shape, but my mind was still full of stuff that just bothered me all the time. And I never addressed it until I got this trauma therapy. I want to go to another subject because I think there's about two or three more subjects I want to talk before this is over. And when I was somewhere in the 90s, we would still have the store, and at Christmas time, we would hire junior high students or high school students to wrap packages for us and run errands because we were all too busy. So this one year, I hired this little girl from a county school. She was just wonderful, cute, smiled all the time, loved life. I thought she was going to go to the top of whatever she chose. One Saturday morning, her best friend, who was also working for us, came to work, came up to me and said, now, the other little girl was Angie. She said Angie took a gun with her to bed last night and killed herself. And then right after that, a friend of mine from college called me, and he was called down to the sheriff's because his 13 or 16-year-old son had been caught breaking into a house. They went down to pick him up from the police station. He got out of the car, pulled out a gun, said, Mom and Dad, I love you, but I can't take it anymore. Shot himself in the head. Those two incidents, because I knew that I had been close to being in their position, started me on a journey of speaking to high school classes about teenage depression. And as you know, the statistics today, it's gotten even worse. Mm-hmm. It's out of control. for just one simple statistic, I'll tell you. 20% of Americans suffer with a mental illness. That's 50 million people. 20% of students also are mentally ill. So I started on this journey of talking to classes, and strictly high school health or psychology classes. And I would speak to the kids, and then I would ask them to come up if they wanted to and tell me what's going on in their lives. And one day this girl came up, and I knew who she was. She was the top student, female student, no, top student, period, top female athlete. And she had an almost perfect SAT score. She came up to me, she says, "Mr. Wilson, I want to die. I am so depressed because everybody thinks I ought to be the best thing in the world. My parents beat me down all the time. If I ever make a mistake on one of my tests, I can't handle anymore." Now, all I could do was say, "There's help out there for you." And I gave her the name of a child psychologist. Never saw her again. I don't know what happened. On that same day, the next girl came up, and she was just a normal kid, 15, 16 years old, probably a B or C student, in pretty good shape. She says, "Mr. Wilson, nobody loves me. My parents hate me. I have no friends. I want to kill myself." I told her the same thing. You know, I gave her words of wisdom, and then I said, "Go to this lady, and she can help you." Again, I don't know what she did after that. And if you look today, as I said, it's even worse. These kids are just suffering like crazy. And so are adults. And the statistics prove about the same for every major country in the world. So I came to Phoenix, and I thought I would start up again giving talks to high school students. Well, nobody would let me. They said I was too old, which was ridiculous. My story resonates with all these kids. So anyway, I answered an ad to paper, and I became a facilitator for mental health support groups. And I've been doing that for 8 years. And I have seen directly how many face-to-face people are suffering, what they've gone through, what kind of help they are or are not getting. And their stories are horrific. They've been raped. They've been trafficked. They've been beaten. They've been mentally abused and everything. And one of the things I've really taken away from all this is that in the U.S., there is very little help if you don't have any money. The insurance companies prevent people from getting insured. They have taken the amount of money or assistance they give to psychiatrists and psychologists, cut it badly. They don't offer insurance to a lot of people. The professionals, the providers, have to raise their rates. And so I'm sitting there with all these people. I've seen over 1,000 people in the last 8 years. And they're getting such poor assistance because of two things, the insurance companies and the lack of assistance from the U.S. government. It is pathetic what these people go through.
Couldn't agree more. And Steve, that's why you don't know this about me, but I'll tell you. In my early 20s, so I didn't graduate high school. I got kicked out. And they gave me a diploma, and they're like, "Good luck. Let the streets take care of you." And, you know, I mean, I come from a very traumatic background. Like, there was no father figure. My mother was an alcoholic drug addict. I was in the streets, you know, selling drugs, breaking into houses, stealing cars. Look, I did what I had to do, right? And in my early 20s, I had luckily, maybe, I don't know, figured out a way how to navigate corporate America. And I ended up getting a job in sales at one of the number one insurance companies in the world, a Fortune 10 company. And every day for 5.5 years, I would tell people if they had some kind of mental health disorder, I couldn't help them.
Right.
But I didn't know, like, you don't know what you don't know. And I'm a kid, like, let's call it what it is. At 20 years old, you're a kid. You don't know anything. All I knew is right. I was making a lot of money. And today, what I look at in terms of not only this podcast, but the hundreds and hundreds of episodes, the unbelievable number of free resources I've created. The fact, Steve, I've coached thousands of people for free over the last 8 years. Anyone can coach with me at any time for $0 for 10 minutes. I'll spend 10 minutes with any human on planet Earth. Is cool. Because of what you just said. Because what I realized is that when I worked for that company, I did more harm than good, and I want to leave a legacy better than that. And I mean, that's why for me, this is such a big part of what we do over here at Think Unbroken every day, because the whole thing is about Think Unbroken. It's like, how do you create this? How do you change this? How do you shape this world? And so I want to just take a moment and acknowledge you and give you both gratitude and thanks for your work, because we need men like you in the world, regardless of age, which is the most nonsense I've ever heard in my life. And we need people who can be leaders and step up in a time when we need it. And so, you know, I greatly appreciate you coming on the show and being a part of this conversation. I greatly appreciate the work that you've done for yourself, for your family, and for others. And so just want to give you some gratitude for that. As we run out of time here, I do have a couple other questions for you, but I want to be mindful here. First, I'm just really curious, if somebody is listening to this and maybe they don't have the resources that they need, they've listened to a bunch of my shows, they've read the books, blah, 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 but they just need a little bit more. What do you suggest they do? Where does somebody go and continue to find some more support?
Well, every state that I know of has its U.S. government what you would call clinics. They can get long-term disability and they can get free medications and things like that. In my estimation, it is so poorly funded and so understaffed because there are millions of people who need assistance and they go to these clinics. And sometimes it's very difficult to get an appointment. Think of it this way. If you're in distress, you're thinking of killing yourself, and you have nowhere to go, and you call the hotline, and they refer you to a U.S. clinic of some kind, and they say the next appointment is a month from now. Well, you're in distress. You may not make it that month.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I've got money. I can go and call up my psychiatrist and get in that day or the next day. But all these people who are, let's face it, making less than $100,000 now, don't have the money to go to a therapist or a psychiatrist. Mm-hmm. My trauma therapist was $200 each session. You tell somebody who's making $30,000 or $40,000 they got to pay $200. And it's going to take years of help. Where are they going to go?
Yeah, agreed.
So insurance companies are the biggest problem. They refuse to help people. The government won't make them assist people. When I got my first life insurance policy, right under the heading was this is null and void if you have a mental illness. Mm-hmm. Now, that was back in the 1970s, but there's a precursor to what we're talking about.
Yeah.
And the government, they like to say, oh, look what we're doing. Well, they're not doing anything compared to what they need to be doing.
No.
So it's a real problem. What I hope to get out of doing these podcasts, and I've done about 40 of them now, is to get somehow, and maybe with your help and your other podcast buddies, you can get the word out about how insurance companies and the U.S. government are dropping the ball on mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
That is what I want to accomplish. And it's very difficult.
Yeah. But
here and there, make some problem or make some waves.
Yeah. And you are. And my hope is, you know, the thousands of people who are going to hear this, you know, we impact them. They share it with 1,000 people and so on and so forth. And obviously, I'm going to continue to do my best to offer these resources to give access to incredible people like you who have transformed their life and become the hero of their own story. Before I ask you the last question, Steve, where can everyone get the book and learn more about you?
Well, the title of the book is Teetering on a Tightrope, My Bipolar Journey. It is available at Amazon. It is available at Barnes & Noble. I'll tell you what I mostly use the book for, because the topic is so genre limiting. I use the book because I don't know how many books I've sold, but it's sure as hell in the runaway bestseller because of the theme. Mm-hmm. And it's written in a way that describes me down and dirty, everything that happened. But I use the book to be able to get into shows like yours and on other shows and talk about other things that aren't so prominent in the book, such as the failures in the system to help people. I don't remember exactly what your question was now that I've spouted off on that.
No, no worries. Well, I was asking where people can find the book, but we're going to put that link. Guys, go to thinkunbrokenpodcast.com. Make sure that you grab a copy of Steve's book. It's unbelievable. And if you or someone you know has any type of mental health illness or disorder, education is your best friend. I can promise you that a book like this is going to impact your life for the better. My friend, my last question for you, what does it mean to you to be unbroken?
Well, it's pretty easy in my mind. I'm unbroken because I got rid of the shackles of mental illness and can pave the way for other people to get help. The first 40 years of my 75-year life to now, I couldn't even help myself. So now I'm on a journey to hopefully get something done.
Mm. And I know that you will, and I know that I'm here to support you. Steve Wilson, thank you so much for being on the show. Unbroken Nation, thank you guys for listening. Please make sure that you share this episode, because every time that you do, you're helping others transform their trauma to triumph, breakdowns to breakthroughs, and helping them become the hero of their own story. And until next time, my friends, be unbroken. I'll see ya.
Thank you so much for listening to Think Unbroken. Please share this episode with someone who could use it and help us move forward in our mission of ending generational trauma in our lifetime. And if you would, please take 5 seconds to pop on iTunes or Spotify, hit that 5-star, leave a review, and you can also reach out to us on social at Michael Unbroken or at Think Unbroken. And of course, you can check out our YouTube channel at Think Unbroken. Thank you for being a part of Unbroken Nation, my friends, and until next time, be unbroken.